As a writer, I get stuck every so often straining for the right words to tell my story. Over the years, though, I've learned when to quit tying myself into mental knots over sentence construction, instead stepping back and rethinking where my story is going. This process is essentially what millions of American working families are going through this year, as record numbers of them are shocking bosses, politicians, and economists by stepping back and declaring, "We quit." Most of the quits are tied to very real abuses that have become ingrained in our workplaces over the past couple of decades. Poverty paychecks, no health care, unpredictable schedules, no child care, understaffing, forced overtime, unsafe jobs, sexist and racist managers, tolerance of aggressively rude customers, and so awful much more. Specific grievances abound, but at the core of each is a deep, inherently destructive executive suite malignancy, disrespect. The corporate system has cheapened employees from valuable human assets worthy of being nurtured and advanced to a bookkeeping expense that must be steadily eliminated. It's not just about paychecks. It's about feeling valued, feeling that the hierarchy gives a damn about the people doing the work. Yet, corporate America is going out of its way to show that it doesn't care. And, of course, workers notice. So unionization is booming. Millions who were laid off by the pandemic are refusing to rush back to the same old grind. And now millions who have jobs are quitting. This is much more than an unusual unemployment stat. It's a sea change in people's attitude about work itself and life. This is Jim Hightower saying people are rethinking where their story is going and how they can take it in a better direction. Yes, nearly everyone will eventually return to work, but workers themselves have begun redefining the job and rebalancing it with life. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you lowdowners who subscribe to our monthly newsletter, The Hightower Lowdown. You know who you are. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the nurses at St. Vincent's Hospital in Massachusetts filed an unfair labor practice charge with the National Labor Relations Board against their owner, Dallas-based Tenet Healthcare. This is the longest strike in Massachusetts, the longest nursing strike in Massachusetts history. I think they went out sometime early in March. And the thing that gets me is, and I say this all the time about these kind of strikes, you get these companies who will spend untold fortunes just to deny the simple things that working people need, like a decent wage, decent health care, a little bit of retirement security, better working conditions. They will spend untold fortunes. And as I understand at this point, they've spent in excess of $100 million. And I got to question you. If they spent that $100 million on better wages, hours, conditions for the nurses that they had that made them one of the top 10 best hospitals in the state, do you think they could have even gone higher and better? But this is about control and power. And ultimately, me, in my view, it's always about breaking the union. But here to share some thoughts on what's going on in Massachusetts' longest nursing strike, I've asked Marlena Pellegrino to come talk with us. Marlena is a 35-year nurse at St. Vincent's Hospital. She's also on the negotiating committee there. Marlena, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So am I getting this right? This Tenet Healthcare from Dallas? From Dallas. I don't know why a Dallas company is owning a hospital in Massachusetts, but that's another argument. Right. That they've spent $100 million on this so far?
Absolutely. I think it's in excess of $100 million. We went on strike on March 8th for safe patient care, actually advocating for our patients, nothing to do with wages, trying to work with this company for over 2.5 years before we went on strike, doing everything we could to avoid this. But in the end, they dismissed our concerns, and we had to take that step that we didn't want to, last resort, and we've been out on the sidewalk for 177 days, standing up for our patients.
So, you know, this is the thing that gets me. I mean, you guys, the nurses, the people who work in hospitals, the people who last year were calling frontline heroes and essential, and, you know, we were applauding in public Granted, I don't know that they gave you any raises or even a pat on the back as an atta girl, but
no.
You know, I'm looking at this going, is this how we treat our heroes?
Yeah, well, apparently this is how Tenet Healthcare Corporation, this is their, unfortunately, a for-profit, you know, multi-billion dollar company. They really have no roots in our community. We're a community hospital, and they have come in and basically they've stripped every bit of the identity of St. Vincent Hospital, a very over 125-year-old Catholic-based hospital. They've tried to strip us of our identity, of our ability to actually advocate for our patients. And as soon as a certain administrative group came in over the last 2.5 years, a certain CEO, we could see the changes right away. There was undermining of our union rights immediately. There was anything that we did that she did not agree with was seen as something that needed to be very punitive. It's been a very toxic work environment, and at this time, they have been undermining our strike as we have been on strike before we went on strike, as we have been on strike, and up until this date, they are undermining our ability to maintain our strike by intimidating our nurses, by coercing them, by retaliating against us for illegally going out on strike. It's very distressing at this time, and we could have had an agreement about 2 weeks ago. We met after a very, you know, very long strike, and we could have come to an agreement on the prime issue we're fighting for is safer patient care, more registered nurses at the bedside. It basically comes down to if they put a few more nurses on every shift, we would not be on strike, and they would not be spending this money. But it's really about ego and power and control for them. So at this time, they're denying us our right to go back to work to our same exact jobs, and we've not been able to settle the strike because of their unlawful behavior.
So really, you know, and looking really at this, the question I always ask, because you know, if it's not about money, it's not about wages, it's not about benefits, it's not about those things. It's really about making the hospital a better place by giving better care to patients. Something I would think a hospital would want. Then is it about breaking the union? Is it about just getting the union out so that they have dictatorial control and to hire and fire and discipline and do whatever they want, however they want, whenever they want?
Yeah, 100%. We felt that 100% before we went out. Those threats were made. It was made known that they want our union, the Massachusetts Nurses Association, they want them out of the hospital. They don't want us to have a legalized voice in any way. And they've made that very clear with every action they've taken, that the larger issue, the larger agenda, there's a very sinister agenda here, is that they do not want us to have a union in that hospital. And I believe that they are trying to make an example of us. They own about 67 or 68 hospitals across this country, multiple hundreds of surgical centers across this country, many not in the Northeast where I live. And they definitely are trying to set an example for their other facilities by trying to break our union in our hospital, which will set a precedent for them across all of their hospitals. It's very, very dangerous. And it's not only dangerous for workers like nurses, but it is very, very dangerous for patients. You know, patients, obviously, if you're in the hospital, you're very vulnerable. You're at a time in your life where you need extra care. You need someone to be at your bedside. You need someone to meet your needs. And it's not a CEO or an administrator that comes into your hospital room 24 hours a day providing comfort or pain medication or education. And it's very, very sad that they call themselves a healthcare corporation and they would actually put their own self-interest, their own ego and need for power and control over the safety of our patients are suffering in Worcester. In our Worcester community, this hospital has closed beds, done everything they can to keep us out of the hospital while our patients are going without care, and they're receiving very poor care from the nurses that they've flown in from all over the country. And it's mind-boggling to caregivers like myself and the 700 nurses I work with. We can't even wrap our head around that kind of lack of compassion. We just think, what is wrong with these people's soul? Actually, we're confounded. But we stand strong. I mean, you have to. I mean, patients' lives are on the line.
No, and good on you. I've been following this for some time, and you know, look, one day longer. But you know, I'm looking at this and going, you know, these corporations have no soul. They're not people. No matter what Mitt Romney says, it's all about the bottom line, and they're proving it. And look, the scab nurses that they bring across your picket line, they're not the best and brightest. If they were, they would be on somewhere, you know, taking care of patients there. But what do you say to the people, Marlena, who go, you know, if you care about the patients that much, you know, why go on strike? Isn't there a better way?
I wish there was a better way. And if anyone knows nurses, you know that a nurse's strike is very, very unusual. And to have nurses on strike for 6 months, you have to question the leadership of the hospital that would allow their nurses to get to that point where they are so despondent. Every shift, we were so despondent that we felt that we had no choice. We were forced out the door. We for 2.5 years, we tried every measure that we could, meeting with management, every unsafe staffing report. We took a no-confidence vote in the CEO. We signed petitions, hundreds and hundreds of us. We wore buttons. We had informational tickets. We had standouts. We had staffing symposiums. We had negotiations. Not one thing worked. They basically disregarded every concern that their professional registered nurses have. It's really a slap into the face to our profession as well. I mean, we hold a license to practice nursing. If we're telling the administration, who do not hold medical degrees, that it's unsafe to care for this number of patients or this acuity of patients, we're telling the truth. I mean, our job is to care for patients. So at a certain point, you reach the point that if you're leaving every day, your license is in jeopardy, you know your patients are unsafe, and the hospital will not listen to you, you take that larger step, if you have to, and you take it outside to the street to let the community know this is what's going on, in the hopes that in the end it makes it better for everyone. If you sweep these things under the rug, as these corporations do, if you let them beat you into submission, if you sell your soul to the devil, which is what we say, I mean, it's just straight up what we say, then you are consistent in their behavior. And at some point you do, the group of nurses I work with, we felt we needed to take this on. It's not something we wanted to do, and it's not something that you do lightly. Like I said, it was in the making for close to 2 years. So, you know, it's something that these corporations force workers to do, and it's very sad. It can be avoided if they actually cared about their patients and cared about the safety of their patients.
Yeah, if they just sat down and bargained in good faith. And I don't, from what I've been seeing, I don't see the good faith because I don't know anybody who wants to go on strike. It's the absolute last arrow in the quiver. And it sounds like you guys were pushed to the extremes. And look, you're right. At some point, you've got to take the last stand and say, you know, we've done all we can do. Because look, I've been in the hospital a couple of times. I've been very fortunate, haven't ever really, really been sick. But the handful of times that I've spent a night in the hospital, the nurses have always been fabulous. They've always been the people who've, you know, told me what to expect. They've always been there to have a comforting word, to educate, to do all the things you said. I can't imagine them being stressed to the point of the stories that I'm hearing now, and not being able to do their job, and just exhausted and worn out. Because my fear is these corporations keep pushing you. Eventually, all the good people leave, and all we're left with are the scab nurses who are willing to cross your picket line.
Right, yeah, and that's something we don't want. That, you know, I mean, nurses have, we're not a stranger to hard work or challenges. And I think there obviously there's nursing is a female dominated profession, and I believe that is, we have wonderful, you know, male nurses, and we have lots of them, but to be frank, it is still a female dominated profession. And I think corporations like this, they take that as a sign of weakness. They don't realize how strong nurses are. And if you back us into a corner and our patients' lives are at risk, we are going to take that stand and stand up for our patients. There's nothing worse than having an assignment of patients that you know where you're choosing which patient you're going to give care to and which patient you're not going to get to. When a hospital corporation administration puts you in that position, that's a very bad position to be in. It's not something that a professional registered nurse wants to do, and they'll do anything to stand up and advocate for what their patients need. We were talking about patient safety. I've been a nurse a long time, as you said, 35 years, and I celebrated my 35th year anniversary on the picket line, advocating for patients on the street and not at the bedside, which I would prefer to do. We miss nursing our patients, but when you push nurses to that point, they will stand up and do the right thing. And in the last 3 months that I worked before we went out on strike, I saw more patients fall in those 3 to 4 months than I have in 35 years. That's a problem. That's a problem that lack of staffing, lack of resources. And when this hospital, during COVID, they furloughed nurses, they sent nurses home, they made sure we had the minimum amount of staff while they made money off of a pandemic. That is something that cannot be tolerated.
That's disgraceful.
That's just evil.
That's
it's just
disgraceful.
Plain old evil.
So,
right.
So two quick questions. One, the community support is ultimately one of the most important things you can get. What kind of response are you getting from folks in the community? Because, look, you're part of the community. What kind of responses are you getting from folks?
The Worcester community we are humbled by the support we have received for the 6 months we've been on strike and in the months before that. We have been, Worcester is it's a very labor-friendly town. We're a very, a blue-collar city. Our patients are our friends. They're our neighbors. They're our family members. They know us by name. We're a community hospital, and they have been solely behind us, really the entire way. We're out on the picket line till midnight every, 18 hours a day for 6 months straight. The beeps, the waves, the people stopping by our strike office to offer support, offer donations, bring us food and coffee on the line, have cookouts for us. And it's just they stop on the way, even out of the hospital, patients stop and say, keep going. You're doing the right thing. You're supporting us. It's really been an unbelievable experience, something you don't want to have to do. But you can see that the community understands that the nurses are the ones that care for them, and we're doing this for our patients, though it's very hard to do. So they've been really amazing.
I give you credit. Keep up the great fight. How can we help?
Well, you can get the word out that St. Vincent Hospital nurses are still on strike, and that 10 Healthcare Corporation is conducting some unlawful anti-union strike busting tactics, and that people stay tuned. And we do have a website. There are donations to the St. Vincent Hospital Nurses Strike Fund. Obviously, it's a lot of months on strike, and just be on the lookout for the truth. Nurses are telling the truth, and just keep up the fight for fighting for unionized workers, and know that we're doing what we can to care for our patients. So, we just want people to be aware of what this corporation is capable of, what they're trying to do to us, and to help that not happen.
Do you have a strike fund? Do you guys have any strike funds or anything that folks can donate
Yes,
to?
Yes, we do. We have a strike fund. We have a website, St. Vincent Hospital Nurses Strike Fund, that you can donate to.
All right, we'll get a link out to hopefully folks will donate a couple of bucks to help you guys out, because I know these are trying times for folks. Stay the course one day longer. I appreciate the time.
Yes.
I hope you'll come back and
yes,
share
sure.
some thoughts as this continues, and hopefully it's short and hopefully you win.
Thank you so much. Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Good, thanks. Thanks so much, Marlena Pellegrino. Look, this is, as she said, this isn't something people want. This isn't that you wake up and go, oh, I think we're going to go on strike today. No, they were pushed into this by a corporation who clearly wanted to take their union from them. And good on them for standing up to the fight. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1864. That was the day the final battle of the Atlanta campaign began with the Battle of Jonesboro. The Union had been embroiled in a civil war with Confederate forces to end the slave labor system for 3.5 years. It had been a difficult summer. Battles were increasingly bloody, with casualties on both sides numbering into the tens of thousands. Criticisms intensified against key Union generals like Sherman and Grant. Pressure mounted against President Lincoln to end the war and withdraw the Emancipation Proclamation if necessary. General William T. Sherman mounted the Atlanta campaign earlier that year in May. His forces scored a number of victories throughout the summer, but could not decisively defeat Confederate forces. By August, Northern morale was so low that the Republican National Committee deemed Lincoln unelectable. The Democratic National Convention, convening in Chicago, had declared the war a failure and planned to ride to victory over Lincoln in the November elections. But Lincoln's commitment to emancipation was unwavering, and Sherman did not disappoint. He understood that Atlanta was, as historian Eric Foner describes it, a key railroad hub and the communications and transportation center for the entire Southeast. Sherman's forces had been marching down from Chattanooga for most of the summer. Finally, they marched to the south of Atlanta to cut the last key rail line. And on this day, Union forces positioned themselves at the Flint River and at the Macon and Western Railroad. Over the next 2 days, they would successfully beat back multiple Confederate assaults, destroying the rail line and forcing Confederate forces to abandon Atlanta. The city was now fully under Union occupation.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
The reality is nobody likes going on strike. And it's one of those things that when pushed into it, you don't have a choice. And, you know, as I'm looking at this situation at this hospital, they've been out since March 8th. These nurses are committed. And as she said, look, you don't screw around with nurses. They're some of the most militant people I know. I remember a number of years back, we were marching across the Golden Gate Bridge with a bunch of nurses from National Nurses United, and they were people you didn't want to mess with. They were well organized, and they were willing to stand up for themselves and for their communities. And look, this isn't about money, and this is the thing that's important. This is about taking care of people. This is what happens when you privatize things, when everything you have is privatized. This fetish that the right wing heaped upon us for the last 40 years, that government's bad. The private sector is where everything's at. You know, today I was the chew toy for the people who follow the Pizzagate guy. And yet not one of them pointed their finger at the private sector. Who's responsible for this? If there are dogs left behind, and I'm sure there probably are, I don't believe the video that they keep circulating because this is the Pizzagate guy. Not one word about the private sector. Not one word about the profiteers. You never hear them talk about the profiteers. You never talk about the fetishists who have destroyed our healthcare system because we've got to make the rich richer. We've got to pay out shareholders. We've got to pay huge amounts to CEOs and board members. The fact that St. Vincent Hospital was a community hospital for, I think she says 120 years old. And it's owned by a company in Dallas who owns like 60 other hospitals. Explain to me how you're going to get decent care out of that. You're not. You got a bean counter who wants to know how to squeeze the quarter till the eagle screams. Because it's all about the profit. It's not about people. It never is. The only time people are part of the equation is when you can get them all ginned up. When you get them all wadded up in the panties to where they say irrational, stupid things. Which the Pizzagate guy's followers are doing all day today. Because the right can't exist without irrational thought. The right can't exist without people who stop thinking and are just outraged. Who are just angry. And look, the thing is I understand the anger. I do. For some people, I get the anger. Now, understand, most of the comments and most of the retweets and the stuff that comes on Twitter, that's manufactured. That's a game. That's just political theater. But there are a handful of minions who don't know it's a game, that they believe they've found their calling. Their cult is there. They've found a purpose. And they believe, some of them truly believe, that they are defending some illusionary vision of freedom or democracy or liberty, all while being just useful tools for the fascists, who want to continue to privatize every aspect of our lives. These people who are going to be going to board meetings to overthrow the board. These people don't want public education. These people want power and control. And they want to indoctrinate our kids because you hear it in their rhetoric. The left wants to indoctrinate our kids. What I found about the right is the second they say something pointed at the quote unquote left, it's what they're already doing. Because it's kind of like the Trump thing. Trump had diarrhea of the mouth. Something would go in his ear and he couldn't wait to spew it out. He couldn't wait for it to just out. And it's what he would do. And of course he would change it and make it crazier. But this is what they do. Because, hey, what I'm doing, I got to let you know I'm doing it. I got to let you know I'm breaking norms. I'm tearing down institutions. I'm destroying lives. Because this really truly is. For the people who are in the control position, not the idiots who are you know, the keyboard cowboys in the basement going, oh, I'm going to get him. I'm going to make him feel bad. Understand, I never get butthurt. I never get sad. Make all the comments you want. Never. But understand, you're simply tearing this country apart by tearing all of us apart. Because if we can't agree on big things, like the need to rebuild our infrastructure, the need to invest in the future for healthcare, for education, for retirement security for our seniors, taking care of our veterans, where we're going to fight over contractors who left some dogs behind? Is it horrible? Yeah, it's horrible that these contractors left those dogs behind. It is horrible. But it wasn't Joe Biden. Understand, the point is tear Biden down. And why do they want to tear Biden down? So that we don't get the infrastructure bill. So that we don't get the Voting Rights Act. So that we don't govern. So that we don't invest in the future, because the status quo benefits the wealth class of this country. They've got their hands deep in our pockets. They've got their noses deep. They got their snouts deep in the trough. They like it just the way it is. And as disasters happen, bridges collapse and things happen, they just make more money. As we start more wars, they send more mercs. They send more mercenaries. They send more materials. Because it's about profit. Understand, you're being used. It's about the money. It's always about the money. That simple. Let's take a quick break. When I come back, our good friend Greg Pallas is going to be here to share some thoughts on Ed Asner's passing and what's going on in Texas with voting. And Georgia with other stuff. Quick break, right back.
waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in their new world. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitative child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays, were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, sad news yesterday. Ed Asner passed. Ed Asner was 91 years old. And great guy. We had the opportunity during our labor history tour to meet him. I got to do a short interview with him. The kids sat on his lap. We took pictures. Great guy. He was in, I think it was Kansas City is where we were. And he was doing a one-man show on FDR, and just a really good, solid, decent human being, and really a strong union guy. Sad his passing. He had 91 good years. Here to share some thoughts on his passing and what he meant. I've asked Greg Palast to come talk with us. Greg is an investigative journalist, author of numerous books. Too many for me to name off. But if you go to his website, gregpalast.com, they are all there. Greg, thanks for taking time for us.
Glad to be with you again.
So, I saw that, Ed Asner had done, some readings of your book. And I go, I wanted to get some thoughts.
Yeah, well, not only did he do some readings of my book, but he also, one of my books was The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And he read the chapter about my investigation of Walmart, called What Price a Storgasm. And as usual, he was insanely brilliant. I had all these great actors doing parts like Alec Baldwin and others, but I hope they're not jealous, but Ed blew him off the stage. The other is he was also a cameo. He played Santa Claus in my film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, explaining how Wall Street works. It's just brilliant. And he was also a billionaire. He was just funny as could be, and I was telling his stories. Some people don't like it very much, but we're shooting the film, and he has to play. And I was afraid to tell him. I showed up, and I was afraid to tell him, "Listen, you're gonna have to put on a Santa outfit and a goofy beard." And he was game. He said, "Fine, no problem." And he's one take wonder. He did it brilliantly. And then, but he was in his 80s, And of course, with his prostate, he had to take a bathroom break, but where he's all wired up and it's difficult, and he didn't want to stop the production. So he said, the heck with it, and just let it rip, then took off his soaking pants and then shot the scenes in his underpants. And it was hilarious. Santa Claus in underpants and this billionaire in a top hat and tuxedo coat, but with his in his underpants. It was just wonderful. But, you know, he did it, by the way. He worked on these projects, by the way, with my film, my books, et cetera, without pay. And there was a reason. He believed that I had something to tell people that ought to be told. And in particular, you brought up that he's a union guy. And I want to tell you, Ed was a steel worker. The only reason he's an actor, he's got laid off at the steel mills. He was happy to have a good union job in Chicago area. He was like, he was from Kansas City, by the way. And, you know, good union guy and a guy of great feeling. And one story that's really, really important to tell is, you know, everyone, he's known and all the obits, you know, basically say Lou Grant. For those who remember the Lou Grant, the Mary Tyler Moore show, you know, the irascible guy, that was really him. He really played it with heart. And here's the thing. It was the number one show in America. And not only that, as my Swiss in-laws tell me, it was the number one show in Switzerland and throughout the world. It was the top show on this planet. They were all, oh, my God, you know Lou Grant. But it was Reagan was president. It was 1986, and Mary Noel Nuns had been murdered. About four of them had been shot in the head, and we saw these horrible photos of these executed nuns by right-wing death squads in Salvador, backed by Ronnie Reagan as part of his, you know, Stop the Commies operation, supposedly the Mary Noel Nuns. So Ed, who wasn't really that political at the time, he had strong feelings, but he hadn't involved in politics. He agreed to go to a press conference and come out against, believe it or not, against killing nuns. How about that? Now, you'd think that that's not too controversial.
No.
I mean, I don't kill nuns. I don't think you do, Rick. So he's against nun killing. But the heads of the Screen Actors Guild and Ronnie Reagan and his crew absolutely went after Ed, literally saying he was a danger to the nation. And the sponsors just all canceled, you know, the sponsors began canceling their sponsorships. But he still was the biggest, so he's going to get sponsors. But the network canceled him. The network canceled him for his political beliefs, and they canceled the number one show in America because he came out publicly against killing nuns in El Salvador. But he, rather than kiss the network's ass, he said, take your show and shove it. He was blacklisted again for a while because of that, but then came back with a roar, and you know him from Up and other things.
Yeah, that's how my kids know him. It's the guy from Up. Yeah.
Yeah. Great voice. What a voice. That's why he's the best voice actor in America. And I was just thrilled to have him lend his voice and his Santa Claus to my films.
No, he will most certainly be missed. And I was saddened because he was so gracious with my kids, and he was so good with his time to give us, you know, some time to talk about unions and workers and his experience, because he went through that. He was a steel worker and that he played football there at the high school that we had seen him at. You know, it was one of those memorable things that my kids won't forget. And I remember him just being a true salt of the earth guy. And I wanted to, you know, pay him a little tribute there.
And also, what's great is that he took over the Screen Actors Guild, which had been Ronnie Reagan's operation. So the progressive did take the guild for a while. They've lost power since. But I got to tell you, that was, you know, kind of a democratic socialism was his strong belief, because he said, that's, you know, I'm a union man. And he stayed a union man his whole life. That's really defined him.
Yep. No, I'm. He was a good guy, and rest in peace. He will be missed. I want to get your thoughts about what's going on down in Texas. Evidently, the Texas legislature rammed through their voter theft bill. It's going to go to Abbott's desk, if it hasn't already, to be signed. I want to get your thoughts.
Well, look, obviously the Republicans are afraid of voters. You know, they're basically taking the position, if we let people vote, we lose. That's exactly how it is. I mean, there, you know, of course, the canard of voter fraud, you know, and It's very dangerous stuff. You know, it's simple things like they don't want to have drive-in voting. You know, if you've been to Texas, people, you know, live in their cars. No, okay, that's no good. You have to have an excuse from your mommy and your doctor and your juju man to get an absentee ballot. So, you know, you have to stand in line with the maskless COVID morons in Texas to vote then. You know, they're just dumb tricks. They just don't want people to vote. And they're also, of course, spending a lot of time. One thing that wasn't noticed, and it's not even in the bill, so it's dangerous, it really slipped through, is that Texas has joined a program called ERIC. Now, what does ERIC do? ERIC is a program that identifies people to remove from the voter rolls. Now, why do you remove people from the voter rolls? Well, because supposedly they left Texas. But I did an analysis of this list. It's called the ERIC list. I did an analysis for Black Voters Matter with the top experts in the country. I mean, I got in the, you know, who knows where you live? Amazon knows where you live.
Yeah.
Right now, eBay knows where you live. So I literally got the guys from Amazon and eBay to check their claims that these people have left Texas. And they said, you know, a third of this list is baloney. These people are right there. We deliver stuff to these people. And then I did something simple. I called them up. I met with people and they're still there. So Texas is literally removing a couple hundred thousand. That's not small. A couple hundred thousand people from the voter rolls on the grounds that they moved. They're still there and they're going to end up not getting their ballots or, you know, showing up and being bounced from the polls. And, you know, not surprisingly, Rick, it's people with names in Texas like Hernandez and Johnson, Black. Basically, voters of color, and the color's blue. They know what they're doing.
No, they absolutely know what they're doing. I mean, it's just like, you know, the kind of rage that we're seeing at these school board meetings. The right knows what they're doing. They know which buttons to push. They know which people to suppress. They've got the game plan down. Because look, they've got a slew of think tanks that they pay the best and the brightest huge sums of money to devise horrible schemes to usurp democracy. There's nothing new here. I mean, you've been reporting on this for now decades.
Yes. And, you know, that with Ed Asner's help as Santa. But and behind it, by the way, Ed played a billionaire in The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which you can, by the way, download free in Ed's honor today at gregpalace.com or this week. And because we're making a point, as you said, this ain't cheap. Stealing votes ain't cheap business. You need billionaires behind it. And the billionaires behind this operation, for example, are the Bradley family of Milwaukee. Now, you should, as a union man, they should be in your pantheon of people to pee on because, not write a peon for, but they owned the Allen Bradley manufacturing plants in Milwaukee, which were the biggest employers in the city, union jobs. They sold off the company, sent all of the jobs, all those Allen Bradley manufacturing union jobs went to China. They're gone. And they used the billions that they made. They literally sliced off $2 billion to support right-wing causes, in particular, vote suppression. So you can't remove the union busting from the vote suppression. They go together because, you know, here's the rule. As I say in the film with Ed, you can't take away someone's job and not take away their right to vote to complain about losing their job.
Exactly.
And that's where the billionaires come in. So I'm glad you brought up the money because that's what we got to do. Follow the money.
Because it's always the money. I mean, it's not just Bradley. I mean, I look at that Diane Hendricks, the woman who owns the ABC construction company, who, you know, famously on video, almost orgasmic, asking Scott Walker, when do we get right to work? You know, and she was all orgasmic over the fact that she was going to be able to deny her workers the ability to the right to join and form unions so she could cheat them out of wages, benefits, make horrible working conditions so she could get richer.
Yeah. And we had a brilliant jokester call Scott Walker pretending to be David Koch. And he practically had Scott Walker down on his hands and knees barking. And, you know, so Koch is, of course, infamous supporter of so-called right to work, basically, removing your First Amendment to the Constitution right to free association and join that union. And, you know, so it's union busting, pure and simple. They, you know, it's a profit center. So politicians are a profit center to these guys. And that's the problem. When you're supporting progressives, you're not getting anything. You're not getting like a tax break. You're not getting a contract. You're not getting anything in return. But the right wing guys, they're not supporting candidates. They're investing and they're getting a massive rate of return,
yep.
A massive rate of return. And that's the problem. They have turned politics into a profit center and we're picking up the bill.
No, my grandfather always used to say, if a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it, because they understand return on investment, because they wouldn't be spending that money if it wasn't coming back in multiples. And it is. I mean, you a couple of $100,000 in lobbying, they get billions in tax breaks. It's a good investment if you can get it, I guess. But the sad reality is the rest of us end up getting screwed. And what we end up with is the scenario where we're at now, where the working class of this country is pitted against each other and the rage machine keeps feeding this anger. So we never actually solve the problems that are making us really angry while we're getting screwed consistently year after year after year. It's really a masterful scheme they've devised.
Well, it's brilliant. Like, look at, like Leslie Moonves, who was head of CBS, said, look, you may complain about Donald Trump, but for CBS, he's money. He's ratings. So it was a profit center for them to basically give a platform to hatred, to give a platform to this, crazy, misguided anger and deflect from the real, the real guys that are taking the money out of your pocket and blame it on, Mexicans and union guys and whatever. And that's exactly what's happened. And so, again, I'm glad you're bringing it back to the money, because the money is the game. It's not just, oh, these guys are trying to, these, guys in Texas are trying to stop voters from voting. They are trying to stop people from getting in the way of their owners, of their landlords, the people that own their souls.
Yep. And the thing is, I don't know if you've been paying attention to the school board meetings that are going on and the new breed of insurrectionists, because I'm expecting, a January 6th every couple of days now, as these nitwits start going to these school board meetings. And I don't know if you saw today in Georgia, a bunch of these anti-mask idiots shut down a vaccination site. And I'm going, this is all planned, organized, and funded by our billionaire class to continue to cause chaos and division. So that, again, the old Jay Gould quote, I can easily pay half the working class to murder the other half. Here it is in action over nothing but a piece of cloth that someone wears over their face.
Well, we could do the Ed Asner response. If you're not going to wear a mask, I'm not going to wear pants. It's real simple. I mean, you can't go, how dare this restaurant make me wear pants when I walk in? What do you mean I can't serve on a jury with no pants on? So I haven't heard any of these people complain about the pants requirement, but, I have no freedom. What? You want me to stop at a red light? How dare you? It's a good thing that the CDC isn't in charge of that. They'd say they just make stopping at red lights kind of a strong recommendation. Stop at red lights. But that's another question. We still have to get over that fear of courage, even at the top levels. So we have to fight back. By the way, how about suing some of these mask holes if you get COVID? If some jerk slams into my car in a parking lot because he's like an idiot and not looking, I can sue him. What about if he kills my grandma because he's not wearing a mask or getting vaccinated and he works in a nursing home? Come on, guys.
Yep.
It's about time we strike back. How about that? But I like the Ed rule. No mask, no pants.
All right. I'm not going to go there with you, but if you want to be, I'll be happy to stand there in support with you. But I hope they take their deworming drugs and drink the Clorox and all of that. We could do with fewer of them. But Greg, as always, I appreciate the work that you guys do, and always great talking with you and having you on the show. Thanks so much.
See you at GregPalace.com. Bye.
There you go. Good stuff. Greg Palast, gregpalast.com. The Best Democracy Money Can Buy is the best book I've ever read. I highly suggest it. Now, there's a bunch of other ones, Armed Madhouse and The Billionaire Bandits and all of those. Go to gregpalast.com. Pick them up. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1921. That was the day the Battle of Blair Mountain raged in Logan County, West Virginia. Members of the United Mine Workers of America were attempting to organize the mine fields in the southern part of the state. The efforts to bring workers to union was met with violent resistance. The miners armed themselves and marched south. As many as 10,000 miners joined the march. They met armed company men at Blair Mountain. In the battle that ensued, 1 million rounds were fired. The mine owners even hired private planes to drop bombs on Union miners. The U.S. Army intervened and the battle ended. Despite not being successful in their march, the bloody battle brought national attention to the violence in the coal fields. But that was not the last battle for Blair Mountain. In 2011, there was a proposal to bring mountaintop removal mining to Blair Mountain. This type of mining blasts off large chunks of a mountain surface to get at the coal seams below. Protesters stood against the proposal. They argued it would be environmentally devastating to the area. They also argued that it would blast away one of the most important sites of labor history in the nation. Some coal miners took exception to the protests. In a CNN documentary on the conflict, one union miner said, quote, "Mountaintop removal is what built this house, sends that little girl to school, provides insurance for my wife." But another miner joined in the protest against removal. He told CNN that miners had been, quote, "brainwashed to think, oh, I can't have a job unless it's a mountaintop removal job." In 2014, the state prohibited surface mining at Blair Mountain. For now, but that is subject to change. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I always find Greg Palast to be hysterical. Mask holes. Mask holio. Oh, jeez. You know, we're in interesting times. We really, really are in interesting times. Anyway, the U.S. Forest Service, they have closed every national forest in California because, well, wildfires. Bunches of them. Last number I saw was like 107. And, you know, I got into a whole bunch of trouble on the Twitter sphere because I had the audacity to say the only reason that one of the fires, you know, came out and got more attention than all of the other ones was because it was going towards where rich people lived. Because, well, we can't talk about the rich people. I think Rich O'Jett is right. We got to eat at least one of them. And then maybe things will change. Although I doubt it. I look at some of the comments that people are coming up with about this feigned outrage of these couple of dogs that someone took a video of that nobody knows what this video is, but they've got a narrative and they're going to hold on to it. Just like, you know, because remember, this is the Pizzagate guy. This video is coming from the guy who was behind Pizzagate. Not to be trusted. But the faithful, and they are the faithful. Because if you go through and you read some of their profiles, the ones that are actual people, not the bots and not the ones that were created just to, yeah, me too, yeah. You know, the guy who started the account back in 2011 has tweeted twice, and once is now. You know, because they created a bunch of these fake accounts just for this purpose. This is not new. But the people who are there, who are actual people, they're the ones who are the follower crowd. And they're going to follow these charlatans and these grifters. They're like televangelists. They're like political televangelists. They're spreading the ideology. They're spreading the rhetoric and the propaganda. Or as George W. Bush said, catapulting the propaganda. Because it's how you keep people stupid. If you can demonize the other side, he hates dogs! He hates dogs! That's the best they can come up with. You hate America and you hate dogs. You know, and mom and apple pie and baseball. I happen to really like baseball. But this is where we're at. And this is what crazy right-wing media has gotten us. This is what it's putting us in this spot to where we talk about how much we believe in democracy. How much, you know, and I hear right-wing people tell me this all the time. My Republican friends are, no, I believe in democracy. We just have to do it my way. Which means, you know, multiple barriers in front of people to vote. I see no reason why we can't have same-day registration. I see no reason why we can't have mail-in voting. When I voted in this last election, only the second time in my life I voted early. One time I knew I was going to be away for work for a couple of days and I was going to be out of the state. I went to the county elections office, said, hey, I'm going to be out. Had to sign this affidavit, go through this whole thing. I got the ballot, I filled it out, and I turned it in. Wasn't too bad. Wasn't overly onerous. I was okay with it. This last time, I simply went to a website, said, yep, this is me. Send me a ballot. They sent a ballot to my house. There it was. I filled it out. I put it back in the secret carrier envelope. I signed it, put it in the travel envelope, and I dropped it in at the box at the elections office under the guard of a deputy sheriff. A couple days later, they sent me an email, said, hey, Rick, we got your ballot. We're going to eventually get a count. A couple of days after the election, they finally got around to mine. They said, hey, we counted your ballot. Got an email saying, hey, all good, man. I'm confused at how hard and how difficult that is and why anyone would oppose it. Oh, that's right, because the former guy lost. And you know the former guy did lose, right? Even Paul Ryan came out today and said, yeah, Trump lost. Biden won, Trump lost. How hard is that? For the demented, for the deranged, for the followers of Pizzagate, or Pubesack, or whatever his name is. That's a reality that they just can't fathom. For this domestic terrorist out in the eastern part of Pennsylvania, running for county commissioner, or county executive, democracy isn't something he wants. He wants to overthrow our democratic process. He wants to overthrow the rule of law and install people that think like he does, because he can't win at a ballot box. These people cannot win fair elections, and they know it. They know the rest of the country isn't as crazy as they are. They know their numbers are dwindling, and the more dumb stuff they do, the more people wake up and go, not on board with that. And the more crazy people you got going, hey, we're going to throw the school board out and install our people, the more I hope the Republican Party does what I've been asking them to do for a very long time. Take your party back somewhere close to sane. That's all. If you missed any of today's program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.